On. Thanks very much, Lena Nadlus, for coming on to the show. You're the CEO of Diversity Arts Australia, and I'd really love it if you could tell my listeners who you are, Diversity Arts Australia.
Yeah, so Diversity Arts Australia is the national voice for ethno-cultural and migrant racial equity in the arts, screen and creative sectors. So we basically kind of work through advocacy, research, facilitating conversations and connections, seminars, symposia, internships, traineeships, those kinds of things as well. And we also do strategic projects.
Okay, and I noticed that one of your big helpful things for the screen industry and the cultural industries across the board in Australia was a report that you did in 2018 called Shifting the Balance, which actually got some proper data instead of people just pontificating.
Yeah, so that was a really big deal. So we did that Shifting the Balance report, which was looking at cultural diversity or cultural and linguistic diversity in leadership within the Australian art screen and creative sectors. You're right, the data's from 2018, but we released the report in 2019. It was really quite an important report.
Well, the thing about it is that depending on the makeup of the leadership in the cultural industries, they form a gatekeeper role, in a sense, to funding and the development of the diverse groups of people who want to express themselves.
That's right. So we looked at 1,980 people in leadership roles to determine, you know, their kind of cultural background and their ethnicity. We looked at nearly 2,000 people across 200 of Australia's leading art, screen and creative organisations. And we found that on average, 9% of people from, you know, what is called culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and we've used the ABS kind of definition. So we actually looked at first, second, and third generation. Mm. So quite broad. That only 9% there was only 9% average of people from culturally diverse backgrounds in any kind of leadership role in the industry, and that is us being, you know, at the time 39% of the population, people from culturally and linguistically diverse backgrounds, and probably higher when the new census data is all kind of collated and comes out. So it's pretty alarming, and half of the organisations that we surveyed basically had absolutely no one in any leadership roles who was from a culturally and linguistically diverse background. And like you said, leaders are really critical because they really do impact decision-making and priorities, agendas. Like you said, they gatekeep and they really shape the culture of an organisation. They decide who gets employed, what films are going to be made, you know, all of that kind of thing. So I think we wanted to start with that, and we were kind of starting as well in response to, and sometimes including from the screen industry, the challenge that people had set to us, which is you can't prove that.
Yeah, that's
right. You can't prove that, you know, even though we knew it, we had that kind of lived experience. A lot of the people we worked with had been, you know, reporting their experiences of exclusion. And so we wanted to start there with leadership because we thought that's a really critical area and that's an area that we can measure.
Yeah, it's quite clever. I mean, it's like that old furphy about women just aren't good enough and that's the reason for why they're not getting leadership roles. I mean, it's just a load of rubbish, really.
Yeah, so one of the questions that one of the journos asked after we released the report was, why aren't people applying for the jobs? And so it's the same thing. And I was a bit, just a bit taken off guard by that question. I was kind of like, no, it's not that people aren't applying. It's that they're being locked out of these roles, just in the same way that women have been locked out of, you know, a lot of areas of the industry for a very long time. And it's not because the talent's not there. It's because people hit a ceiling and they're not kind of able to go any further. And I think, you know, I've spoken to, you know, filmmakers who've said, I don't know how many more times I can be mentored or how many more times I can be in attachment. Like, I'm like in my mid-30s now, or, you know, it's time. But there's got to be those opportunities that are open to them, you know, and to support them to those leadership pathways or other areas of the industry.
And of course, it's also about, you know, what do people think are important stories to tell? And having people of a specific background choosing what's going to be shown and how people are going to be shown melds the entire culture of a country. We've got a responsibility, don't we?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, we do. We definitely do. And it's really, you know, important that there are people with lived experience, with a diverse kind of amount of lived experience across the industry, who are involved in deciding what stories get told and also directing and producing those stories that are told. Our friends at Media Diversity Australia released a report called Who Gets to Tell Australian Stories. They were looking at people who were news readers and, you know, people kind of, I guess, in broadcasting kind of roles, and something like 75% were from Anglo-Celtic backgrounds. So that's not quite the same, I guess, as as someone just in the screen industry, because they were looking across kind of broadcasting as well as screen. But it's still very telling, I think. It's like 75% of people are from one particular background. And I know that there's a lot of complexity within Anglo and Celtic backgrounds, but it's still excluding a lot of the population, a significant amount of the population. And it's disproportionately high compared to Anglo and Celtic representation in the population.
Oh, it's also about power dynamics and what's considered to be important. It's interesting, I did an interview with Beck Cole, who's part of the crew of people who made We Are Still Here. And there's a sequence in that film that was contributed by Samoans. And there's a sequence in it where the fellow who's an Anzac soldier he's a Samoan. Who would have thought that poor old Samoans were at Anzac as well? Because it's a personal story. He's eating this horrible spam from a can and he throws it away. And Beck said, perhaps we could leave that out because, you know, we want to tighten it up. And they said, no, because it's really important, because when the colonial powers came to our countries, they got rid of our ability to actually feed ourselves locally and made us eat this horrible food. So it was incredibly important and symbolic to them to leave that piece in. But she didn't know that.
That's awesome. That's really important. And it's important that she listened and left it in, because I think sometimes you do hear stories where people are, particularly like if you're talking about people who end up playing a cultural consultant kind of role on a film, and they, you know, sometimes there's kind of stories about how people who don't have lived experience are picking and choosing what sections of the story are the most relevant, and in that process kind of deleting or, you know, editing out those really important stories that, like, I guess in Beck's case, she found out about that actually that was really symbolic of, colonisation and the impact that it had on people having control over their own land and production of food. That's a really awesome story. And
let's get on to this other thing, which is that Diversity Arts Australia has fed into the Screen Rights Cultural Fund. They've funded Fair Play on Screen. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. So the Fair Play on Screen program is really focused on strengthening the screen industry, particularly in the area of cultural and racial equity in terms of people from culturally diverse, people of colour, migrant and refugee backgrounds. But the program also, there were 13 masterclasses, and it took an intersectional approach and also included masterclasses that were led by First Nations people and people with disability or disabled people as well. So it was really about strengthening the screen industry in terms of its equity and inclusion goals by providing a series of masterclasses that were really, that provided really actionable and practical strategies for organisations and companies to make change, because particularly for small to medium green organisations and businesses, they don't often have access to this training, but we know that there is a desire to make change in, you know, the areas that they work in and to kind of think more and act more in terms of equity and inclusion and anti-racism. And, you know, that was the aim of the project. And initially we were going to work a lot more intimately with fewer organisations, but of course, you know, COVID and the floods and, you know, all of the things that have happened over the last few years meant that we ended up being quite flexible, responding to what the people in the industry were telling us and developing it as a series of, 13 masterclasses that were also kind of available on demand afterwards for people who might not be able to make it. It was a tough time for the industry, but it was an amazing program. And we had over 280 participants and a lot of organisations.
So when you say that, are you saying like the production managers and people like that from different places would have involved themselves in this?
Yeah, we had people from all over the industry. We had like people from Cecil Films, from Screen West, from Laundry Lane, from different film festivals. We had some of the, I guess, service organisations like Cinewest and Documentary Australia. So we had a real diversity of people attending in all different roles in the industry.
Right, so though the intention is very open-hearted. They really want to have a more diverse industry.
That's right. Yeah, I think that people do. And so the sessions were structured to be really relevant and practical. So there were sessions like, you know, how do you, you know, act as a director in an inclusive way? So like inclusive directing, or how to be anti-racist in the screen industry and what that looks like. Trying to think cultural safety. We had a few sessions on cultural safety, on accessibility, but everything was tailored to the screen industry. We also had a pretty awesome session with Deborah Williams, who is from the UK's Creative Diversity Network, which is a screen-based peak organisation over there. And she has lived experience as someone who's a black woman and disabled and extensive experience in the screen industry. So she also, you know, talked about towards an inclusive screen sector. So each of the sessions was really structured to be relevant to the industry and to be supporting people. And then we had those more, I guess, even more practical sessions about how do you put together an equity action plan or whatever people might call it. But so we also had sessions like that.
All right. And are you seeing any outcomes, positive outcomes from this, or is it too soon to see?
Well, immediately afterwards and during, we had an awful lot of positive feedback. The program didn't finish that long ago, so we will be doing like a follow-up in 6 months, and we'll be doing another, you know, we'll be doing follow-ups in terms of evaluation and seeing what the longer-term effects of it are. We've had heaps of feedback. One thing that was really surprising was that we actually had a lot of people with lived experience, like people of colour, disabled people, attended the masterclasses. Some of those people we actually knew were very knowledgeable and very experienced in the subject area, and we were interested to know what brought them in. We were so happy they were there because it made the conversation so much more richer and deeper. And they were saying that a lot of them have experienced a lack of cultural safety or marginalisation within the sector, but being able to be in a space where this is talked about openly and be able to have, you know, be able to articulate that in this kind of collective way was actually quite empowering for them. That's a pretty cool outcome.
Yeah.
People told us that they really felt like they had learned some practical skills in terms of, you know, how to attract more diversity in their workforce, and that they were going to implement those, think more about things, listen more, reflect more, and also look at how they could extend, you know, the kind of cultural safety frameworks to the work that they were doing. So there was lots of feedback like that.
I mean, considering that people from diverse backgrounds, culturally and linguistically, without even thinking about disability, make up 40% of the population, I mean, it's the norm, it's ordinary, it's the world.
Yeah, and that's why it's every day, but it's always so surprising and a little bit shocking when the underrepresentation is, you know, well, let's just say the overrepresentation of some groups. And it's along class lines as well. It's not just along race lines.
It's along all of those lines. It's a bit like that. It's not, when you said what you just said, it's like it's not a black problem. It's actually a white problem.
Yeah. I think so. And so, yeah, I like that. And I like what you said earlier about power, because it is about power, and it is about, you know, challenging that and, you know, taking back some of that power.
How much funding did were you able to get from the Screen Rights Cultural Fund for this? Because it sounds pretty ambitious.
Yeah, it was very ambitious. We got $25,000.
Good.
And so we were really happy with that. That's what we asked for. And then we kind of matched, you know, funding for that. But it really was like such an awesome pilot because, you know, what I really appreciated, Screen Rights were really there supporting us when we needed to adapt the program. They supported us the whole way through. But also it's super hard to get funding for this kind of work, which is not, you know, making a film, supporting the industry, you know, I guess in quite a deep way that can lead to some really significant changes in the way films are made and the kinds of films that are made in the industry. So just their vision in supporting us was really critical, and it also was super successful. So as a result, we've been developing kind of online training offerings that we can also provide on demand, and we'll be also trying to continue it and looking at other, you know, sponsors and avenues to be able to do this every few years, like as a live thing, and then also having some online training. Because the thing is, with all industries in the creative industries, there's always high turnover, and also things shift, language shifts, ideas shift, and so this kind of work, there's no end point. It's ongoing. It's like ongoing learning that we all need to do. I always tell my kids when I was at uni it was really radical to change he to she. They're really outraged by that because they say that's just really binary, Mum. I'm like, yeah. So, you know, like things are always developing and, you know, shifting. So we need to, so yeah, so being able to provide this ongoing and seeing it as something that is, it is ongoing, it's ongoing learning, and we all need to continue to do it.